afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We are starting just a couple of minutes late. We're going to try and move this through as quick as we can. However, my hope is that you've scheduled your time in your offices to be here through 4 o'clock today through Wednesday. And then we'll try and have work sessions on Thursday on some of the bills to wrap them up. This morning, let's see, I need to announce this is the House Committee on Revenue. This is April 11th, and we're starting at about 5 minutes late. So I'm going to open a work session for the purpose of permission to request a bill draft. The House rules require that bill draft requests after the House deadline must come through the committee and the Speaker's office. If the Speaker approves this request, the Legislative Council draft will come back to the committee for introduction. Representative Esquivel now moves that the committee request a bill to be drafted to complete the committee's work plan. There being no objections, any discussion?
What if I object? No, I'm just teasing.
Any objections? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. We'll, the clerk will reflect on the record that Representative Hass is excused, and we will the chair is moves that we suspend rules to allow Representative Berger to vote on the request, which we've just had. Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Representative Berger, how do you vote relative to opening the committee for a draft?
Aye.
Okay. With that, we will now close the time for the motion work session to bring in a new draft bill drafts to finish the work which we've been given. And again, I will excuse Representative Hass, who is away on other legislative business. We will now open a public hearing on House Bill 2832. Let's see if we can, Mary, if you'll come forward. Thank you, Paul. Mary, if you'll come forward and bring the list with you, I would appreciate it, or have the list brought up.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon.
House Bill 2832 provides a 5-year special assessment for qualified residential properties that are renovated, subject to approval of renovation plans by the Department of Revenue. The special assessment freezes the value of the property at the time of application, after which its value may grow by a maximum of the greater of 3% per year or 100% of the property's maximum assessed value, subject to special assessment from the prior year. If the property is disqualified from the special assessment, the difference between the taxes due and the amount that would have been due will be owed for the period during which the property was specially assessed. In addition, if the property is disqualified, a penalty of 15% on the taxes in arrears and interest on this balance will be owed. Mr. Chair, I do not have a revenue impact at this time for the reason that I'm not really sure at this point in time what the renovation plans would be. Okay, and they have to be defined, I think, for the statute by the Department of Revenue. So we could be talking about a big plan or a very small plan.
Thank you very much, Mary. We're sending out to see if Representative Dallum is going to come forward. And pending his arrival, we would like to invite Gil Riddell and Mark Milkus from Linn County. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. I'm accompanied by Mark Noakes, who's the Director of Assessment and Taxation for Linn County. Last week, I tried to get a grip on this concept and was not terribly successful, and asked Mark to check with his colleagues in assessment and taxation at the county level and get some feedback about to identify the issues, get some feedback about the sense that the folks who would have to administer this have about this. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I just turn it over to Mark to report what he learned.
Thank you, Gil. Mark?
And good afternoon, Representative Chair Butler and committee members. My name is Mark Noakes, and I am the Linn County Assessor and Tax Collector. And today, I'm here representing the Oregon State Association of County Assessors, as well as my own county, Linn County. And if if the responses I've received from my fellow assessors are any example, probably AOC as well. But what it comes down to is that this law requires the assessor to capture, record, respond, and track an application, review plans, and make decisions regarding what is and is not a renovation. As has already been stated, renovation needs to be further defined before we can really figure out what that means to us. But in any case, my compatriots have told me, and I pretty well interpreted the bill the same way, is that we are going to need an increased staffing level to do this, because many properties that permits are taken out on currently have the potential to fall under this category. One county estimated they do 10,000 permits a year. You can imagine this is a larger county, and they're guesstimating at this point that 20 to 30% of the permits may fall in the renovation category versus new construction or new improvements. What this means to our offices, obviously, is more manpower or the ability to administer this program. Additionally, we may, at least those counties that currently do not have a historical program, they may need some programming ability or hardware or software installations. We currently in Linn County have historic properties. This bill has many of the some of the same wording that the historic program has in it, But there are very few examples, under 100 in Linn County, and Linn County has a lot of historic properties. Some counties don't have any. They don't have to deal with what this bill will have to do, and that's basically exempt and treat differently improvement value versus land that many counties have, specially assessed farm and forest land, but not improvement value. So that was one of the issues that one county came to me saying, responded to me last Friday, was we don't have the ability to specially assess improvements. Again, what this means to a county is cost to try to come up with a program, because there's going to be many, many more examples and occurrences of this type of property qualifying if we understand the bill correctly. And, of course, we won't know until the criteria is further explained to us. In a nutshell, I would say that additional planning will be needed in counties that have sufficient applications, and we do not call this a special assessment program. New value is not added to the assessment roll for 5 years. This is an exemption program. And in addition, the bill as it's written today actually takes value off the rolls, current values. And I would be happy to entertain any questions at this point.
Thanks, Mark. Do you have any idea why this doesn't require a constitutional change in ballot measure 4750?
Chair Butler, I'm not really clear, because it's not raising taxes.
So because it provides an exemption, it probably doesn't.
It's actually lowering.
Yeah, okay. That'd probably be the reason. And so the one part of the key is the issue of definition of renovation. What's the public purpose that's attempting to be served here, do you know? I'm sorry I have to ask you that, but Representative Dallum isn't here.
Chair Butler, that is one of the questions my colleagues have asked me to find out, is we do not know the purpose.
Further questions of either Mr. Riddell or Mr. Noakes? Thank you very kindly. Thank you very much. John Phillips, if you'll come forward, please, representing the Department of Revenue Real Estate Appraisal Unit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. John Phillips, the Oregon Department of Revenue. This bill does call, as Mark and Gil pointed out, for the department to define by rule the further definition of the word renovation in the bill. And, Mr. Chair, your question about the public purpose is my question also. It would help us to be able to define the term if we understood what we were trying to accomplish with the bill and what your public policy is. So the terms state of utility, efficient contemporary use, alter the character, and renovation, all identified in the first 10 lines, is something we could really use some clarification with. So,
but it leaves you folks, if I read line 9, the Department of Revenue may use a further rule to find what constitutes renovation. So, but you need some direction in that regard, at least on the record, I would think, John.
Yes, I think this would border, Mr. Chair, on us establishing tax policy at a rulemaking level. And
so the issues, if I look at restore or alter, those need to be defined. Return the property to the state of utility, that needs to be defined. For efficient contemporary use versus routine maintenance, other action taken to protect the condition of the property, repair the property that does not alter the character. Okay.
Yes, and I think that, at least my reading of the bill, I cannot see in here where it limits the amount of renovation. So if you renovated a kitchen, the entire property might just have a frozen taxable value. So it might involve a couple $1,000 worth of work, or $20,000 to $30,000 worth of work, or it's really not clear.
So page 1, 5 through 9 needs some work there if we're to proceed forward, and then we'd need to know what the public purpose served, what's the purpose of this.
And the department would be happy to work with the drafters.
Great. Well, assuming that these folks can come forward with some good ideas as to what the public purpose served was. Questions, further questions of Mr. Phillips? Thank you very much, John. Colleagues, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2832 and move forward to House Bill, 3359, isn't it? Yeah, 3359. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3359 if the clerk will bring forward the paperwork on that. Please, Mary.
House Bill 3359 clarifies existing law by exempting from property tax aircraft used or held by foreign-owned carriers. It applies to tax years retroactively beginning on or after July 1, 2004. As background, let me say that any aircraft that is required to be registered with the Department of Aviation is actually exempt from property tax, whether it's foreign or domestic. However, it also states that the registration is not required if the aircraft is licensed by a foreign country with which the United States has reciprocal relations, exempting aircraft registered in the U.S. Therefore, in some instances, foreign-owned aircraft carriers are currently exempt from property tax. The confusion is that, obviously, some entities aren't registered, and therefore they are not exempt. The Department of Revenue has not assessed any foreign-owned aircraft carriers, and no taxes have been paid by them. However, in 2004, it had been assessing one airline under the property tax provision 308.558 and subsequently retracted its notice of assessment based on the advice of the Attorney General's office.
Thank you very much. Let's see. We have Pat Egan and John Phillips. Pat, would you like to come forward and... John, you're welcome to come forward, too. Let's go ahead. And this colleagues, this bill is set for a public hearing today and a work session tomorrow.
Pat? Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much for the both the opportunity to have the bill heard and for your and the vice chairs for signing on as sponsors of the legislation. And let me just start by saying I'm very happy to be here today, because of the reason that this has popped up on the radar screen, so to speak, is that we have international nonstop direct service to Frankfurt, Germany through Lufthansa. And ultimately, I think the bill summary has it right, that it states the exemption. This does not provide a new exemption under the law. It states an exemption. And the reason that this popped up is that after a lot of pageantry and a lot of fanfare, we got the landed, so to speak, the Lufthansa direct non-stop direct flight from Portland to Frankfurt, Germany. This is an aircraft, and this is a company that is located, headquartered outside of the bounds of the United States, and the aircraft itself is owned outside of the bounds of the United States. And as your committee staff ably pointed out, this is in contravention of both federal law and international treaties. And yet, when the Department of Revenue looked at its statute and were performing their duties, as you can see in Section 1, Subsection 1 of the bill, they were simply doing what the statute says, which is to assess property tax on the aircraft. So we heard after they had done so and had sent the notice to Lufthansa, we heard from them rapidly, from Lufthansa, our good partners, and they said, well, Port of Portland, what is going on here? We've landed in 14 other states, we're not assessed property tax in 14 other states, and why is it that Oregon is doing this? And I said, well, let me see what we can do. And Director Harshenko and the department, I've got to say, were just fantastic throughout the process in working with us. And working with Lufthansa and, I must say, Mexicana, Korean Airlines, and some others that have been involved here, where you have the aircraft that's owned and operated and the headquarters are outside of the bounds of the United States. So 3359 is the fix that we think we need to make sure that the Oregon state statute says what federal law and international law says for some policy reasons. And I'm going to just give you a quick example using, and also for our own commercial purposes, using the last two major international flights that have been located in Portland. And I must give the plug that we are the smallest airport in the United States that has direct nonstop flights from the airport to both Europe and to Asia.
The smallest, Pat, but it sure isn't the ugliest of all the airports that are out there.
Well, we have proof of that, which I could give you another plug. But the Lufthansa example is a good one because there you have an aircraft that is domiciled and for tax purposes is outside of the bounds of the United States. The Northwest Airlines, that's the airline that goes from Portland to Tokyo, is based and headquartered in the United States. That aircraft is subject to Oregon property tax and would be subject to property tax in any state because of this international treaty and the balance really in the reciprocity of not taxing that aircraft in Japan, for example, and also having the Lufthansa aircraft subject to tax in Germany. So we think 3359 is very straightforward, very short bill, provides the remedy that we're seeking. And again, thank you very much for your consideration. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Pat Egan, Port of Portland. John Phillips, why don't we have you go ahead and testify while you're right there, and then we'll go for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, John Phillips with the Oregon Department of Revenue. No quicker way to get someone's attention than to send them an assessment.
Very true.
I'm going to guess it isn't small on a 747 either.
It was not small. But what Pat's saying is true, and we looked at the statutes, and it actually says domestic or interstate. And since international was not mentioned, then we began discussions and came to this understanding. So this, we believe, will clarify the statute. And
thank you very much, John. Questions of either of these two folks? Representative Riley is recognized.
Thank you. Pat, I noticed in the beginning of your testimony, you said that this hit the radar screen because we landed Lufthansa, and I think we should make sure that this bill has wings.
Not
wheels. He was in the airport.
Chair Representative Riley couldn't agree more, and I hope it takes flight for the Senate.
Late at night trying to think that out.
With that, other questions from these folks? Thank you very much for hearing and seeing none. I didn't have anyone else signed up for this, so we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3359. Be back tomorrow for a work session on this, colleagues, on that particular issue. We'll now open a public hearing on House Bill 3353. Mary?
Mm-hmm. House Bill 3353 prohibits local governments from imposing taxes or fees except a privilege tax upon telecommunications providers unless authorized by statute. Requires that the length of a contract between a municipality and a telecommunications provider may not be shorter than the average of the maximum maturity of general obligation bonds sold by the municipality as determined by the Oregon Municipal Debt Advisory Commission. Does not apply to a tax or fee pursuant to an ordinance or other local government act in effect on March 15, 2005. Current law enables municipalities to levy up to a 7% franchise fee, also referred to as a privilege tax, on telecommunications service providers. Some of the I spoke to one of the lobbyists for the providers, and I've been told that some believe that this law was intended to enable municipalities to obtain sufficient funding for them for the privilege of doing business in their jurisdictions, thereby eliminating the need to introduce miscellaneous charges at a later date. However, recently I've been told some cities have been considering new charges, some have added new charges, and others have shortened the length of their contracts with the telecommunications providers. I have no impact at this time, simply because I haven't really, it's prospective, but it's actually effective as of March 15, 2015, so I'd really have to deal with the city to find out if any of them have done any passing of ordinance since that date.
Okay.
Okay. And that's
thank you very much. We'll invite Brent Wolf to come forward. Let's see, maybe Shelley Jensen, too, from Verizon.
Thank you.
And Eileen Benner. We call this one panel. How's that? Thank you very much for one thorn and two roses. So. Brent, you signed up first. Why don't you go ahead and start off, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brent Wolf. I represent the Oregon Telecommunications Association, and the OTA is a trade association that represents both small rural telephone companies providing service in remote areas as well as larger companies providing service in urban areas. The OTA asked this bill to be introduced simply because we wanted to bring some clarity to a situation that we believe is growing more and more confusing and onerous as time goes by. As staff indicated, municipalities currently can levy franchise fee or privilege tax in the amount of 7% of a local telephone company's basic telephone service, dial tone. That's your basic service. And that was negotiated before my time in some previous legislation, and it was capped at that 7%, as was indicated, to provide enough revenue for cities to not only manage the right-of-way, but I think also for other uses as well. Currently, there's at least one city that has enacted what they call, I think, a license fee or a registration fee that is assessed on telecommunications services that people choose to subscribe to, those things above and beyond dial tone, like voicemail, et cetera, things like that. Other cities have ordinances on the books that they're not actively using. I think they're just a placeholder ordinance in case they want to enact a fee or something above and beyond the 7% franchise fee. This bill, House Bill 3353, would clarify what we think the intent was of the original legislation, that is to cap that revenue that cities can tax or levy a fee on at 7%. If you look at the bill, I don't know if you have the bill in front of you, but if you look at the bill on page 2, section 5, subsection 2, I mean, there's original language in there that indicates telecommunications carriers would not be have to provide any other kind of tax or fee or anything like that. What we did was just introduce, it seemed to us as though there was some getting around the law or the intent or the spirit by calling it something besides a privilege tax. So we tried to include different things to cover all of that, what you might be able to call it, a registration fee or a license fee or something along those lines. And it would just be capped again at the 7%. This bill is not intended to preempt the franchise fee. I know that issues of preemption are difficult to deal with. It does preclude a local government or a municipality from enacting something above and beyond the franchise fee, but the franchise fee stays in place. We're happy with that situation, and we'll continue to pay it. It's lawful, and we don't have a problem with that. The issue of these extra taxes and fees has been litigated fully in the state court system, and the courts have agreed with the municipalities. They can, in fact, levy these fees above and beyond the franchise fee. We disagree with that interpretation of the law, but that's the way it is. It's gone to the Supreme Court, and that's the decision that's been made. The only way, in our opinion, to correct this situation is to pass legislation that would preempt cities from doing that in the future. Any ordinance that's already on the books wouldn't be covered by this law. It's just on a going forward basis. The issue just briefly on the length of the contract. Typically, when you negotiate, if you're a local phone company and you negotiate your franchise agreement, it's a period of 10 years, 15 years, or longer. It's come to my attention that some municipalities have been looking at negotiating those a much shorter period of time, 5 years, maybe 7 years. We prefer the longer period of time simply because if you're a telephone provider and you're paying the full 7%, you may as well do it for 10 or 15 years. It doesn't make any sense to renegotiate it. And obviously, on the other side, if you're not at the maximum 7%, and there are many cities that are not, you want to lock in at the lower rate. It kind of makes good business sense. So those are the two main points of the bill. I would point out, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, there's one section that was either a drafting error or some kind of miscommunication between myself and legislative counsel. On page 2, line 28, you'll notice there's some language that's been deleted. That definitely needs to stay in place. That pretty much is what details what the municipality can levy the basic franchise fee on. So that if this bill were to move forward, we would definitely have to get amendments to make sure that stays in place. Just to summarize, we're sympathetic to the plight of municipalities and their revenue situation. There's just no doubt that everyone's under the gun. There's a fiscal squeeze. We all recognize that. However, 15 years ago, there was a system that was enacted that we believe should be adhered to and kept to, and that's what this bill tries to do.
Thank you, Brent.
You're welcome.
Why don't we go ahead and have Eileen Benner go ahead and testify, and then Shelly Jensen, and I'll go right ahead. Please, if you would, please, Eileen.
Thank you, Chairman Butler. For the record, my name is Eileen Benner, and I'm here today representing competitive telephone service providers, namely Time Warner Telecommunications and Echelon Telecommunications. And I do apologize for incorrectly naming the committee at the top of my written testimony.
Well, we don't pay much attention
to that. Take on anything. Our issues in the competitive providers arena are similar to those that Brandt has outlined for all communications providers. But in addition, we have one issue that is particularly burdensome, and that is that under the current law, the way that telecom utilities are defined, it only defines those utilities which we know of as the incumbents under utilities, those that have been around and typically started out as a monopoly. And it just is silent on competitive telecommunications providers with respect to this fee structure. And that presents an opportunity for cities to tax or assign taxes and surcharges and fees to competitive providers in a manner that they deem appropriate, whereas with a telecommunications utility, they're subject to the law, which limits them to a 7% cap on gross revenues, which are currently defined as local access services. So what we found is that some cities are assessing the 7% on a subset of services to the incumbents, and yet for competitive providers, they're assessing 7% or in addition or even higher fees on all services. So we as competitive providers are having to pass on a greater tax burden to our customers for the same service and for other services than are the incumbents. This bill would alleviate or correct that situation by redefining or taking out the definition of telecommunications carrier and replacing it, if you will, with a telecommunications provider, which then expands the meaning, the companies that come under that definition, to include any company that provides telecommunications service. So that is one major reason that we support the bill. Other reasons I've enumerated on my testimony include some rather business-like reasons which any company, any service provider would like to have removed from having to burden their customers with. As Brent has alluded to, the tax has grown to cover more than just the cost of the service cost of getting into the rights of way. It has become a major revenue producer for cities to use to fund their budgets. And it's unfortunate that it has become that, because then telecommunications customers, and we're talking about a residential consumer who has a telephone, obviously, for a lifeline, all the way up to the largest business, are paying through their telephone service for all kinds of municipal services, whether they're aware of it or not. They have to pay it, and it really is a regressive tax structure, the way that it burdens consumers, even low-income consumers, and there's no real way you can avoid it. It's in many ways, it's like a sales tax. And this bill would at least cap what could be charged and not allow new taxes to be put on the telecommunications utility services bill or the competitive services. The other problem that we have currently is that cities across the state can impose this tax, or they can or not, and they can impose it at different levels. And this bill would provide some uniformity by at least limiting it to a franchise fee or a privilege tax, and limiting the amount and on what services it can be provided for both competitive and incumbent providers. That's the main thrust of my testimony, and I'd be happy to stand for any questions you may have.
Thank you. If you would stay, please, Eileen. We'll go ahead and have Shelley Jensen testify on behalf of Verizon.
Chairman Butler, committee members, I'm Shelley Jensen. I'm Regulatory and Governmental Affairs Manager for Verizon. And I just want to emphasize a couple of points that have already been made. First, we do not object to paying for the use of the right-of-way. We understand that there is a cost to our being in the right-of-way, and we have no objection to paying the cities for that use. But what we don't want to do is become a tax collector for the cities. There are some cities that have added on additional taxes at different rates to different providers that don't necessarily have anything to do with telecommunications service. It's just because of the city's budget situation, they need additional revenues, and this is the way they've chosen to collect them through us. So that's pretty much the summary of our position, and I also would be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Questions for this particular panel? Members? Yes, Representative Berger is recognized.
Thank you. Brent, I think you probably could answer this. On page 2, language added to Section 4 about the length of the contract.
Yes.
Would you explain how that worked and how you derived that particular number?
Sure. Again, Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, the thought behind that was to, if you negotiate your franchise fee right now, typically it's 15 to 20 years. They're long contractual agreements. Some of my members indicated that some of the municipalities they operate in had wanted to scale that back and only have a 5-year agreement or 7-year agreement. We prefer to have a longer agreement for two reasons. If you're at the maximum 7%, then it doesn't make any sense to renegotiate the franchise fee any sooner than you possibly have to, because it takes time and money. If you're at a lower rate than the maximum 7%, then obviously you would want to lock in at the lower rate. Those are the two reasons to have the longer contract. The Oregon Municipal Debt Advisory Commission, I have to tell you, that was our attorney who did that. I don't know what that number is, but it's a longer length of time than 5 to 7 years. That's all I can tell you on the length of time.
So I guess I'm uncomfortable with this having a nexus that has anything to do with what we're talking about here, because I'm not sure I understand
sure.
it. And I slap myself for using the word nexus, because it's one of those overused words that I apologize, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate you're looking for some way of managing this. I also am sensitive to the fact that the telecommunications world is changing so rapidly that the cities don't want to get locked into 15-year anything. I don't think anybody wants to get locked into 15-year anything. So I would encourage you to look for either a better explanation of this or something else that
Just a straight number, perhaps?
Yes. I mean, I don't even know what this means, I guess, and so I'm a little uncomfortable with it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions for this panel? I did have a couple of questions, and perhaps it's something that that relates to the overall tax presently. It's my understanding that cities can presently tax up to 7%. And Brent, you were involved, and Shelley, I think you were too, when we made some changes on that a couple of years ago, so that not to change the 7%, but for goodness sakes to be able to tell people what they were paying. Because when people would stop to compare their telephone bills from one place to another, or those of us who maybe received our bills in town, at a town address, but were receiving our service out in the country, we were getting billed 7%. We didn't know why. But we didn't know we were being billed 7%. We thought we were being billed some lesser amount. Tell us what the status of that overall hidden charge in our phone bill is, would you please, both before and after that adjustment that we made or asked the PUC to get involved in last session or two sessions ago.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what Representative Butler is referring to is the 7%. 4% of that 7, if your city was charging your local telephone company the full 7%, 4% of that was buried in your telephone bill. You would never see that. Anything above the 4%, in other words, 3%, could be expressed on the bill as a franchise fee imposed by the local city. The OTA had some legislation introduced that would rectify that. That would indicate you can express the full 7% on the bill. That didn't really go anywhere. However, that prompted the OTA to have some conversations with the Oregon Public Utility Commission, whose administrative rule indicated that situation. And they, during the interim, we worked with them, and now a local telephone company can, in fact, express that full 7% on their bill if they choose to do that. And there's some process that you have to go through with the PUC to do it, but you can do it right now if you want to.
Do we know if the phone companies are actually now working to show the full tax so that they can see what they're paying the city? Because I resent the fact that we've got cities that come forward and say we're broke, we're just not receiving anymore, we just need to add a 5% to your telephone bill, and lo and behold, they may already have 2% on the telephone bill already.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I know that some phone companies have taken advantage of that particular administrative rule. I couldn't tell you if
it's a local option.
Right. I wouldn't want to testify if XYZ phone company has or has not.
Thank you. Do we know if these fees are ever voted on by general election ballots amongst the people that they're taxed on?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that is not the case. I think this is an ordinance passed
we'll
by
the city. We'll ask that of the cities, too, but I just would like to know that.
Are you speaking about the extra or the 7%?
Any of it. Any of it. Well. So I didn't know whether you would know that or not, but I'm just anxious to know that. Because we've got, I think in the fairness of, in the spirit of fairness, that we need to make sure that we know what these taxes are. Other questions for members of the committee? Representative Galizio and then Representative Olson.
Thank you. Just to any of you, is it your belief that cities are motivated to prevent telecommunications providers from being available to the residents of the city?
You're referring to the tax itself, or?
Well, just I guess I'm sort of wondering if there's a belief that cities would prefer that there was just some kind of a monopoly and that its residents are not, that the cities would perceive that residents, wait, I'm doing too many negatives. In other words, I'm trying to look at it from a, let's say I'm a city council person. Am I motivated to prevent the citizenry from having options? Do you think that that's the case, that cities do not want options or competition for their residents?
Well,
that's clear.
Sure.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Galizio, I'll just take a stab first. I don't believe that's the case, personally. I just think it's revenue. Eileen, representing some of the competitive carriers, might have a different opinion, but I don't believe that's the case.
I certainly tend to agree with Brad. In fact, I'm sure when these kind of fees were first put into statute with the limiting, you know, there probably were only incumbents, and that's one of the reasons competitive providers weren't addressed in the definition. And they were attempting to recoup, originally, I believe, some of the cost of having to allow their rights of way to be used and something for the value of it. It's just that since then they have become a revenue gainer, and because of silence in the statute and a desire to raise revenue, I believe they've also become anti-competitive, maybe unintentionally, but in the way they're administered by putting a higher rate on a competitor than an incumbent, that's certainly anti-competitive.
Thank you.
I'll have a question now.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Olson.
Thank you.
That response, Eileen, brought up just one more question, and that is that if cities are using these as revenue generators, with the changes in technology that we're seeing, and your companies certainly are involved in some of that, is there potentially a time when Oregonians can use their credit cards to contract with a company in Switzerland to provide all of their telephone services with no hardwired and with no nexus to the state of Oregon, using that federal word, with no nexus to the state of Oregon. They're not advertising the state of Oregon. It's no different than me buying a T-shirt online, I guess.
I'll take a stab at that, Chairman Butler. The public utilities law do require that providers of service, telecom service, be certified by the Public Utilities Commission, and if they're going to provide intrastate service. And that's defined as providing services for calls that originate and terminate within the state. That's not to say that, you know, every company comes forward voluntarily and can be found, and certainly even with the instance of calling cards today, in my testimony I alluded to the fact that there are ways to beat the system, and calling cards and 800 numbers may be one way, because you can make it look like a service goes out of state rather than staying in state, and, mm-hmm. and so it wouldn't fall under the definitions of the statute. And then there are other modes of providing service that you alluded to that are either wireless or satellite that currently don't fall under the tax structure because of the way that the statute's written or the difficulty of claiming those companies or putting them in a certain city. So there are a number of ways to, I think, get around the law the way it's currently written.
So by trying to make something that's uniform relative to the tax and something that defines the scope of services to be taxed, that may give us a better handle on what it is that we're attempting to do, and so that everybody plays by the same set of rules. Is that what I understand, Brad?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's accurate. And what Eileen alluded to is probably what's driving some of these extra taxes beyond that,
right?
Because as basic revenue from dial tone drops off, clearly the franchise fee revenue drops off. And where is that money going to? Wireless, voice over internet. I mean, those are the things that people are using now. And as much as I hate to say it, it's true.
Other questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate your being here and participating. And we'll call up Brian DeLeishman, Drew Hageman, and Richard Kostasan. And Elise Brown is here also from Singular. Oh, well, good. That makes it easy. I was wondering how we were going to get a camp stool for him. Okay, let's see. I've got Brian and then Drew.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Brian DeLeishman. I represent Nextel. You probably are used to seeing me with other hats, but I think the chair was surprised that I represent a corporation. But I do represent Nextel Wireless Communication. Actually, we have an interest in this bill for many of the same reasons that you've already heard, but it's slightly different in that wireless communication is not considered a utility in the state, so therefore the types of historical or traditional taxes that have been levied against utilities did not apply to the wireless communicators. However, we've seen over the last few years the beginning of a process that local jurisdictions are now looking at or have assessed or in the process are trying to assess. I guess what I wouldn't use the term sales tax, but a gross receipts tax in lieu of a franchise fee or any other kind of fee that they have against traditional utility taxes on hardwire. And if you go back historically, again, you've heard the history about franchise fees being having a nexus to use of right-of-way. Wireless folks do not use the right-of-way. They use, obviously, a number of other technologies, including cell towers in which they lease that property, whether it's on public or private land. They pay a direct lease rather than the use of the right-of-way. They pay the interconnection charge when a wireless call begins and then goes into the exchange and then goes hardwire. They pay to the hardwire company that interconnection charge that then goes to pay for the use of the right-of-way for that. So they already pay for that particular portion. So we have an interest in this area of that's mentioned in 3353 in that, again, we're starting to see this jurisdiction by jurisdiction new tax on wireless communications.
Thank you, Drew.
Drew Hagedorn on behalf of T-Mobile USA. I just would echo the remarks that Brian made. I think they're in line with T-Mobile sentiment about the bill as well.
Thank you, Elise.
Short and sweet there. This is Singular's debut here in Salem. Elise Brown representing Singular. And happy to be here. I also wear other hats. And since Singular's acquisition of AT&T Wireless late in 2004, Singular's gone from being a small sliver in the state of Oregon to a major player, thanks to AT&T Wireless. And I worked for the company for about 9 years, so it's nice to be back here talking about wireless issues. And then, again, just to echo what my colleague said, wireless is a very high-costing business, certainly from deployment of networks, and we are already paying the interconnection fees and the real estate fees. So we feel that this bill is problematic from that standpoint. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Elise. Representative Berger is recognized.
Real estate fees. Somebody want to describe?
Cell towers. So we pay a leasing arrangement to private property or public property.
Yeah, those.
You pay anything beyond the real estate tax, or is there a franchise on those as well?
There's not a franchise on those. It's a leasing arrangement.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I may, though, in relation to your question about other taxes, there are obviously other taxes. We pay all the normal corporate taxes in the state. In addition, where we drive our jurisdiction to transmit signals and function comes from the FCC. And so we actually purchase air. We purchase the airwaves that we or frequencies that we operate under. And that is rather expensive. I don't know if you have seen any of the auctions recently, but in relationship to just a transfer of frequency that Nextel did, recently, I believe it was in the range of $4.2 billion that they paid for certain frequencies. So although they don't use right-of-ways, they in fact use the airway right-of-ways, and they pay very, very handsomely at the federal level for that use.
Is that a federal purchase? Is that what that is?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
It's interesting that you're leasing our air out above on top of us, isn't it? No recompense to the state. Other questions for these folks? Thank you very much for coming. We appreciate it. And let's see. Did Richard Kosasen come back in? He was here earlier. Actually recognized that Shelley did such a good job on behalf of Rice. Mike Dewey. That's big time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mike Dewey, representing the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association. Let me do a couple things first. With regard, Mr. Chair, to an election, we will see the first election of on the cell phone side and the long distance side of a, if you will, additional fees or taxes or new taxes in the city of Springfield. The citizens were able to accumulate enough signatures to put that on the ballot, and that's a May ballot. So we'll get an indication of how that might work in the various cities. Representative Berger, to your question very quickly about the number of years, one of the difficulties is you get into a franchise of, let's say, 5 years in terms of borrowing money, your interest rates are going to go up because you may not have a franchise after 5 years. And if you're making substantial capital expenditures and infrastructure and the like, you want to make sure you're able to recoup those costs, and you might not be able to do that over a five-year period. So that's why the industry would like at least 15 years. But I do think it should be a number in the bill as opposed to something that might be a little bit more arbitrary. With regard to the industry itself, as you know, it's changing significantly. The wireless people talked about what's occurring in the marketplace. Right now you have Verizon and Qwest trying to purchase MCI, and that continues to go up and up and up in terms of that battle. I would predict AT&T as a company, and the brand name is not going to exist within the next 2 years. SBC has bought AT&T. They called it a merger, but they purchased that for brand name and its infrastructure internationally, because they were not a competitor, or they were not a player internationally. And with regard to the cable industry, Comcast will soon announce, we talked about voice over internet making telephone calls. It's not over the public internet, it's over their private internet services and their private networks. So a lot is happening. The cable industry is a little bit different. They do support the legislation. The industry agreed in 1984 to a limit of 5% franchise fee. But on that, in some communities, and my good friend, the mayor of Eugene, is here to talk about this particular bill, probably opposed to our position. But, for example, in Eugene, you have now a 2% registration fee. And Qwest litigated that and lost as to whether or not they could do it. So now you have, let's say, now a 7% tax, if you will, as a cable customer, because that cable customer ultimately pays it. I do want to point out, and you're probably happy about this, is that the cable industry does have significant competition from the satellite industry. Quite frankly, at one time, they had more services in terms of channels, and because they were digital, they had a more pristine signal. And so they were capturing and continue to capture market share, and I'll talk about what they pay in just a minute. So you've got 7% in Eugene. If you go to Portland, you've got the 5%, and as I understand, in some locales, there is a 3% fee above that for PEG access. And if you're in the Salem area and you watch cable, it would be the channels 20 through 22, public access, government access, and education access. So you've got 8%. So if you had, in Portland, also a registration fee, you'd have 10%. So do some math with me. You've got a $100 cable bill. I know the good representative doesn't have a $100 cable bill from Salem, but somebody might have a $100 cable bill. And you've got 5%, 3%, and 2%. And on that, arguably, that's a $10 charge. $100 times 10%. Actually, it's $11. Because the base is $110, so it's a tax on a tax. Now, the competition, and the reason we like this bill, our competition, the satellite industry, doesn't pay anything. Now, we all agree we ought to pay for the use of the right-of-way, because the cable industry uses the right-of-way, and the satellite industry doesn't use the right-of-way. But if you've got a 10% tax or an 8% tax, your automatic costs are 8 to 10% higher. And that's somewhat difficult. So if I said to the good representatives up here, you had a business, and let's say arbitrarily someone said, you're going to have to pay 8% to your competition, that isn't going to have to pay anything. We agree we should pay the 5%, but when you get into the additional fees it becomes problematic because we start to lose market share. So that's why we like this piece of legislation. As we lose market share, potentially the communities lose revenues because the satellite delivered programmers aren't paying anything. And we have, you know, we pay the income taxes, we pay the property taxes, we have employees in the community, thousands of employees in Oregon that pay income taxes. We provide free services to schools via high-speed internet or cable television, cable in the classroom, and I can go on and on and on. So we want to look at it from the standpoint of what is best for cities and what is best for Oregon. Now, I would say to you, if you want to find some additional money, where you might want to go, and you can't do it in this bill, but where you might want to go is you might want to tax the satellite folks. You'll have a lot of fun with that. But the fact is, you're going to have to do that because local governments can't do that. The satellite folks have evidently a pretty good lobby because the federal legislation says it has to be a statewide tax. It can't be a local tax. I'm not suggesting that today, but you could raise probably another $11 to $12-13 million on a 5% fee. And we could put some more money towards schools or whatever. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, but we see this as a competitive issue. We think we make great strides for communities and provide good things, but nonetheless, it is difficult as these fees go up. So Mike, that's why we like this.
Help me just so that I understand that what we're doing is we're trying to make this uniform and to level the playing field, but in that process, we're trying to get away from this issue of the of where folks bundle services in other areas and create a loophole in and of themselves by bundling that everyone just pays the tax based upon all services. Isn't that right,
Mr. Chair? If I understand your question, I think the bundling issue is a little bit of a different issue. What we're trying to do is say, at least from my perspective in reading this bill, that we have in statute, and this is what is confusing, the local exchange carriers pay a certain rate. The utilities, which are really no longer utilities, the Quest and the Verizons, pay a different rate. And the CLECs are concerned that they're paying a higher rate than the utilities. Our concern is, as cities or counties, in this case, counties can impose fees upon us. They cannot do it on other telecom providers. They additional fees above the 5%, which is in the federal statute. So everybody has a little bit different issue, but at least you have, I think, in this bill, a little bit more consistency in terms of what you know you're going to pay year in and year out.
And that consistency is what I'm looking for, is some degree of the consistency in a level playing field that would basically provide some uniformity of the tax across the board.
That would be true. And I would say, Mr. Chair, I mean, the bill needs some additional work in that area.
Okay. Any suggestions on that? That would be probably under Section 2 on the face page there under definitions. Is that?
Yes, that would be the place, and we'd be happy to continue to work on that.
Thank you, Mike. Further questions for Mr. Dewey? Thank you, Mike.
Thank you for your time.
We'll now ask Dave Berenberg from the League of Oregon Cities to come forward, and you're going to introduce to us Mayor Helen Berg from Corvallis and the Honorable Mayor Kitty Piercy, former member of the House of Representatives from Eugene. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Dave Berenberg, Legislative Director for the League of Oregon Cities. And to my right is Mayor Piercy, who is the mayor of Eugene, and to her right is Mayor Helen Berg of Corvallis, who is also the president this year of the League of Oregon Cities. And we appreciate the opportunity to testify on this bill today. I thought what we'd do is I will give a little bit of the background on some of these issues and respond, I think, to some of the issues raised by the industry. And then Mayor Berg will speak a little bit about some of the local control and local decision-making issues, and then Mayor Piercy will address the plan and the actions that the city of Eugene has taken and I think has been referenced in some of the other testimony. It's interesting that they've been afraid of testimony today talking about how people support franchise fees. We have just litigated the issue of cities' right to collect franchise fees. We were challenged by the state's largest provider and others in the industry in federal court, and won both at the federal district court level and recently won at the federal appeals court level of our ability and right to collect franchise fees. That's something that was under challenge and took several years of litigation, and a part of the case is still not related to the fees, is still winding its way through the courts. The ability of local governments to charge fees and taxes and revenue is one that is very important to local control and determination. As regards to cities' ability to charge fees beyond just franchise fees for the use, what we consider rental of a valuable public resource, the public right-of-way, that issue has been litigated to the Oregon Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court has clearly sided in a very strong opinion with Oregon City's ability and right to charge these types of fees and taxes. So it is something that is inherent in city authority. Talking about the industry, that cities have been charging a range of up to 7% for local exchange basic dial tone service across the state. Some cities charging competitive local exchange carriers. The market is changing. In the last quarter, the largest provider in the state's revenue, franchise fees have declined 25% in their payments to cities.
The reason for that, Dave?
Well, they have some billing and other issues. There's been a steady decline, and we have a bunch of cities, or a group of cities, have been seeking to audit the company since 2002 and have a date of 2006 to conduct an audit to get to the bottom of the continued decline. Part of the continued decline follows national trends, where there is a decline in revenue on the wireline side and increases in revenue on the wireless and other services side, something I think Eugene has some experience too in being able to see there. That city franchise fees have been assessed, you know, for years and years and years for use of the right of way, you know, going back a century in Oregon. Going back a century just reminded me too of tax policy and the actions, I think, of the industry in bringing forward this bill would be akin to, at the turn of the, going back two centuries now, of saying that we'll give local government the authority to tax buggy whips as the technology is changing, that you can have a very consistent and nice policy, but it doesn't reflect the changes that are happening in our marketplace.
Does this relating clause cover buggy whips? I mean, throw that in there and telecommunications.
Well, you know, that you, Mr. Chair, that you mentioned the bill, that, and folks have really liked turning to page two and referencing sections of the bill. Not being particularly bright, I'll sort of do the same. On line 34, if you follow page two, if you follow the language there, it says that, it probably should start at line 30, but a telecommunication provider paying the privilege tax authorized by this section is not required to pay any additional fee, compensation, or consideration, including the free use of construction of telecommunication facilities and equipment to the municipality for the provider's use of public streets, alleys, or highways, or all of them, and this is where the part I wanted to pick up, and is not required to pay the municipality any additional tax or fee. As that's constructed, it seems to say that they are now not liable to pay property tax, any other kind of municipal tax or fee, by deleting the language beyond that, so that this bill in the, goes beyond just telecommunication fees, but to limit local government authority in its entirety to impose any kinds of taxes or fees on the telecommunications industry. Addressing Mr. Dewey's point, we are willing to support Mr. Dewey and efforts to assess taxes on DBS, and it's not something that's in local government's control. It's a right that's reserved to the state. There is an issue there, and it's one that is in your hands and not ours to be able to resolve. The moving on to some of the issues that the industry has raised, I think the real test here is a test of whether Oregon citizens are going to be have available to them advanced telecommunications services or telecommunications services in whatever form it will be offered in the future. And I think the answer here is yes, that because a city imposes a tax or fee on wireless or long-distance carriers, we're not going to see an exodus of those carriers or those services being available to Oregon cities. And that's something I think that Mayor Piercy can address in her testimony through the experience of Eugene. And when you look at the rest of the country, Oregon is, I think, third lowest of all states in any kind of fees or taxes imposed on the wireless industry. And the fees that we impose are for E911. That you look at our neighbors, and they'll be in the range of some up to 10% and more, some states up to 16%. Taxes on wireless in the range of 8% or more are the norm rather than the exception. So it's been something that has worked in other states, and we think it's something that is workable in Oregon. Telecom industry's ability to pay fees and adjust to local differences. My son got on a plane this morning, my 14-year-old, with his class to go to Washington, D.C., and during the hearing called, and I went out and to say, like a good son should, that he's arrived safe and sound in Washington, D.C. When that bill arrives at my house in 3 or 4 weeks for the phone service, they'll tell me that he made a call in Dulles, from Dulles to Salem, and you know, the technological ability of the industry to adapt and be on the cutting edge is really stupendous. And I think that technology can be employed to address the needs that we have at the local level. So we believe that this legislation really is unnecessary. It's really a local issue that can be decided by local city councils, can be referred by local voters if they're unhappy with the decisions their local officials make, and can be referred with the backing of dollars from the telecommunications industry. It was mentioned by Mr. Dewey that there would be a ballot measure in Springfield on this, and he failed to mention that the telecom industry has spent thousands of dollars in helping to place it on the ballot there, too. So I think the process can work at the local level, and with that, I will, with the chair's permission, pass the microphone over to Mayor Byrd.
Thank you, Mayor Byrd.
Chair Butler and members of the committee, my name is Helen Berg. I'm the mayor of the city of Corvallis, and this year I'm the president of the League of Oregon Cities, and thank you for your time today. And I'm here to testify in the interest of my own city, but also the 240 cities of the state of Oregon. And what we, the 240 cities of the state of Oregon, have in common is the services that we have the responsibility of providing. They're services that no other level of government does provide. And that's why it is our responsibility. And so it's not so much that we have a plight as that we have a responsibility. We don't want to collect money to have money. We need to collect revenues in order to provide services. And those are services to the residents of our community, but they are also services to the business, which include marketing and providing telecommunications to the public. If we do not have the wherewithal in the cities of Oregon to provide good public services across the full scale, nobody's going to make any money. And furthermore, it's very much of our in our interest that the levy playing field be level, and it's very much in the interest of those who provide public services that what we charge is reasonable, because if people can't make money providing telecommunications to the public, they aren't going to do it. And then we would be remiss in our responsibilities in that extent, too. The reason that we always stress local control in these issues is that we really do believe that in many of these challenges that we meet, the answers lie locally, because they tend to be slightly different from one community to another. And as Dave mentioned, we have an open and accessible decision-making process at the local government. We had no choice. We wouldn't get away with anything else. We run into our constituents in the grocery store. And anything that we do is also subject to voter referral and initiative. So we're very confident that we have the democratic process at the local level, that we have the knowledge at the local level of what is needed. Again, both, well, on three fronts, our citizens, our residents, our people who do business, and the need for government services. Now, what we have in telecommunications, as Dave pointed out, of course, is a changing world. I understand why one might give up a hardwired telephone. I have a cell phone that I pay a bill for every month, and I have it mostly so that I can be sure that I'm reachable even when I'm not at the grocery store. But I have more time on there than I ordinarily use, and so I do all my long distance on there because I've already paid for it. So, and these kinds of decisions are affecting all kinds of people. So as this situation changes, and this major source of revenue, and I do want to stress that for very many cities, franchise fees have been the second largest source of revenue after property taxes. So this is not a minor change in our revenue picture. But it hasn't finished changing yet, I'm sure. We're somewhere on the sea wave here. So you can imagine my feeling when I discover that as I am testifying here today, there's also Senate Bill 1030, which would grandfather our franchise fees. But here I am testifying on House Bill 3353, which would preempt some other source of revenue for telecommunications. So you can imagine how uneasy I am that I'm in the shifting sea, and there's bills in this legislature that are going to take away both our options. So I'm here very much in favor of our options. Just one last thing I would like to say. I do not see any need for the state to limit city authority. We're not going to have the ability or any incentive to behave arbitrarily. Everything that we do, particularly with major businesses operating in our cities, is a matter of negotiation and mutual benefit.
Thank you, Mayor. Mayor Katie Pearson.
Thank you, Chair Butler and members of the committee. It's nice to be back in the building again. And today, for the record, I'm Kitty Piercy, and I'm here as Mayor of Eugene. Thanks for the opportunity to share with you some facts about the city of Eugene related to House Bill 3353. This bill strikes at the very heart of Eugene's successful telecommunications strategy to prepare our city for the 21st century information age. The City of Eugene put together a comprehensive process to plan for the future, brought in community stakeholders, and managed to get agreement and put forward the City Ordinance 20083. Four telecommunications companies have challenged ordinance in court, and both the Oregon Court of Appeals and Supreme Court have upheld Eugene's ordinance. You'll find that in Attachment A. I am aware that House Bill 3353 may not impact our own ordinance directly, but this legislation is damaging to local authority and planning. And I believe our city is obligated to apprise this committee that local telecommunications authority has been, in our experience, and is, and will be, working in our communities. I'd like to just give you an account of Eugene's story. In April 1997, the City of Eugene completed a year-long project to prepare a comprehensive plan to address the new telecommunications environment. Recognizing land use, regulatory infrastructure, and financial impacts, the City Council adopted 9 objectives to cover the city's varied interests and responsibilities as a major user of telecommunications, a landlord manager of the public right-of-way and infrastructure, and as an advocate for individual and corporate citizens, as Helen mentioned. The need for a telecommunications plan was driven by two key events. First, the Federal Telecommunications Act of 1996 deregulated telecommunications. I was here then, and required cities to allow telecommunications providers to use the right-of-ways and specify that local government could not be, quote, a barrier to entry, unquote. The second factor was the sweeping changes in the telecommunications industry. New providers were entering the market, and the city of Eugene expected increased placement of telecommunications towers and other infrastructures in rights-of-way and other areas of the community. In May of 1996, the Eugene City Council formed the Council Committee on Telecommunications, CCT, to prepare a telecommunications plan. The membership of the CCT included three city councilors and was chaired by Councilor Nancy Nathanson, who would go on later to be a member of the Federal Communications Committee's Local and State Government Advisory Committee. We had a lot of expertise at the table. The council also added a member of the Budget Committee and a member of the Planning Commission, as the plan would include significant land use and financial issues. After over a year of city council meetings and public hearings, the city council adopted two telecommunications ordinances, one to address siting of cell towers, the other to assure that the city provides a level playing field for telecommunications competition and that all our citizens benefit from the increasing use of public property by the industry. Private and public carriers owning facilities in Eugene pay compensation to the general fund whenever they place their facilities in the public right-of-way, called license fees, in Ordinance 20083. The City Council also adopted a carrier telecom tax, and it's called a registration fee, to be dedicated to reinvestment in the new city telecom-related projects of broad community benefit, which I will say a bit more about in a minute. By December 2003, the city had prevailed in all four court challenges to the city's ordinance. During litigation, collection of some fees and all tax collection was suspended. When court judgments were issued in support of our city, collections began immediately and some projects began almost immediately. Attached, you'll find a list of projects funded under this ordinance. I'd like to highlight an important one, a program that was on the cutting block before this ordinance directed funds to save it. The Community Emergency Notification System, or CENS, C-E-N-S, is a county-wide, not just our city, but a county-wide communication system used to alert citizens in the event of a disaster or emergency, serving as a reverse 911. An authorized public safety official can request activation of the system that can, within minutes, send phone messages with warnings and critical safety instructions. It is a tool with unlimited value to public safety, especially in these times. CENS is capable of sending approximately 2,000 calls per minute, and it is used to send a recorded phone message to all telephones in a specific geographic area. Examples might include homes in an area threatened by a wildfire, or those within a certain distance of a hazardous material spill. Each message sent consists of four parts. One, an introduction identifying that it is an emergency notification and giving the name of the public safety official who has authorized the call. Two, description and location of the emergency situation. Three, instructions of actions to take, such as whether to evacuate or shelter in place. Four, closing information and details. So in summary, the goals of the telecommunications plan were implemented to balance a reasonable business climate. You will see that in your attachment C, while supporting community values for broad access to the information highway and neighborhood livability. Eugene's regulatory approach works in our community, and it is within the range of land use and financial policies implemented in many other communities across the nation. I thank you for this opportunity to apprise you of our experiences and hope that will help you addressing this bill.
Thank you very much, Mayor Pearson. Questions of this particular panel? Representative Galizio.
Good afternoon. For David, I had two questions. If I could just ask them, and then you can. You mentioned that Oregon had the third lowest fees, and I was just interested in the source of that. And then secondly, you also mentioned that people in cities, should they take take issue with fees can put forth a referendum. And so my question, though, is considering the testimony that preceded you that these fees are sort of hidden and the telecommunications companies become sort of de facto tax collectors, how would the public know that this is indeed taking place?
Mr. Chair, Representative Galizio, I'm happy to provide the committee with a chart that is actually from an industry study that had the relative rates of the different states. So I will supply that to the committee. For your second question, we didn't oppose the industry's efforts at the PUC to require disclosure of franchise fees. What had happened was cities, I think, as you heard before, could charge up to 7% for use of the right-of-way. The PUC, through a proceeding a number of years ago, determined that 4% was a cost of doing business and embedded that in their rates. And any city that wanted to charge more, would the 3% could appear on the bill at the discretion of the company. I think the PUC action, as described earlier, allows that now to be a choice of the utility or the telecommunications company. So they can choose to disclose or not to disclose, as they can with any other fee, and they can compete on that, buried in their rates, have lower rates, or disclose.
Representative Esquivel.
Yes, a couple things. One is I would assume, Your Honors, that you have a public hearing every time you're going to move a franchise fee one way or the other. Is that correct?
Our communities.
Having said that, when you have these public hearings, I remember the one that had the most attention when I was on a city council was when we were going to raise the franchise fee on cable TV $1.43. And everyone was all over us like a biting dog over that $1.43. And the people did come in. They did state their position on it. And they were very vocal about it. The good thing about local government is that, what do you meet, twice a month? Mm-hmm. You can go in there at any time during that time and advocate one way or the other. We in Medford do put this fee on the bill because on several occasions this has been pointed out to me very precisely that it's on my bill and why is it there, and then you go into the dissertation and then you're accountable to the people of the community. So I just wanted to point those couple things out. Public hearings, people's input, and that it is on our bills.
Dave, how do you feel about the fact that you mentioned that the telecommunications providers and others had encouraged the vote in Springfield? Is that something that you would advocate, that folks ought to have these votes?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that look at it a little bit like the legislature and ballot measures. I think that different communities have different characters, and city councils, and some may choose to lead the way. Others may choose to refer, and citizens in the places where people may choose to lead may choose that they led a little too far and put items on the ballot. But I think that it's just the system that we have, and I think it provides an opportunity for communities to tailor an approach that works for them. I think some communities will probably stick with what they've got. Some communities may try some programs like Eugene has. And just if I may digress for one second from the answer, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to tell you what Springfield was doing and the vote in Springfield. Springfield took a different approach, which was to say, we're going to have a 5% tax, gross tax on all utilities, not just telecom, but all utilities, defining utilities broadly. And as it applies to telecom, it applies to all of telecom, no matter whether it comes through the air, the ground, or technologies yet devised. And I think their thinking was to try to have something that was very clear and very level, except, you know, industries coming in opposing that. And I think level playing field differs from where one sits as to what is a level playing field.
And as you're aware, I've got another piece of legislation out there that says that you won't do that. You won't get out and compete with private business unless you do have votes. And I guess the League of Oregon Cities has probably been the poison pill in the well over that whole issue, trying to make sure that we didn't have any opportunity to vote on those kinds of things, attempting to try and tell folks that they shouldn't vote, shouldn't have that right. And I guess I guess when I hear that revenues are going down as a result of efficiencies and these kinds of things, I don't know that I've got a great deal of sympathy for the folks that say, hey, we've got to have the same amount of revenue just because your companies aren't doing as much or aren't selling as much in my city. It all brings to mind the whole issue of what of the fact that folks are choosing to say, hey, the same as Mayor Berg, I'm using this cell phone because it's cheaper to use this. I've already paid for the base service, which includes 300 or 500 minutes, and I guess I'm going to use those, and that's the cheaper way for me to go. But then we say, wait a minute, just because it's a cheaper way for me to go, now we've got to charge a higher fee for us to stay alive. And I'm trying to draw the line between the dots as to whether or not the folks, city residents, ought to have the right to vote on these kinds of things. And then what happens? What happens, as Mayor Piercy says, when folks are choosing to also move to satellite systems or systems that you really have no nexus to your community? How are you going to reach out and grab a hold of that, Mayor Piercy? I need to know that.
I need to know that, too.
Mr. Chair, a couple of different answers to your questions. First is, there's a question and will be of nexus. And there are new technologies, VoIP. There's nexus in doing it some ways and nexus in probably doing it in others, you know, where people are doing business and having facilities in the state where, you know, there is nexus. And computer to computer raises a lot of issues. I think that some of that's not yet fully resolved. I think we are in a brave new age. So there will be changing technologies. Some of it will be subject to, I think, state taxation. Some of these issues are going to play out at the federal level, and there's federal legislation, and to some degree we're a pork bobbing on their sea on some of these issues.
Okay. What of the 5% straight across the board that Springfield's trying to do? Where we've got bundled and unbundled services and cell phones and, mm-hmm. and satellite hookups and direct computer-to-computer service through broadband, wouldn't that be the simplest way to just land on a 5% and everybody go home happy?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think in this area, cities are to some degree being the laboratory of democracy, you know, in the states, or just, you know, trying some things and seeing what works best. I think Springfield went at the idea and that, gee, this is a level playing field. This is something that hits across the board. We hope that we would get support from the industry because from what we've been hearing and understanding about level playing field, we think this is it. So I think that with some surprise, you know, other than, that they faced, you know, opposition. So
that surprises you?
Well, I was going to say that, no, it doesn't surprise me, Mr. Chair, in that you have some folks who, under the current model used in Springfield, aren't paying any taxes, the wireless folks. And people who aren't being taxed would say, gee, it's a level playing field because we're not using the right-of-way or being charged for use of the right-of-way. So, you know, that's fair. And then you have, as Mayor Mayor Berg mentioned, in the Senate there's a bill that says you can't charge franchise fees. You have to charge a sales tax in a particular way, which is sort of the opposite of this, and it's being forwarded by another segment of the industry. So, you know, it's hard to look at and find something that works. I think Springfield's one is one that had promise, and the citizens in Springfield will decide whether we'll have an opportunity to see if it works.
I guess your tone when you said, well, the industry has supported a vote on that made me think that maybe that wasn't the best way to do that. And you're perfectly happy to see that happen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think as, you know, One of the examples I've been using when I've been talking about just local taxation and options and how cities are different has been your Ontario, your community's example with the sales tax. I
mean, 1% sales tax. And several city councilors stake their vote, their reputation, and their job on that. They're no longer with us. They figured it was a 70% sure shot to go ahead and get a 1% sales tax in exchange for a 10% reduction of the city property tax. And those folks are history. And the vote was 70% in opposition.
Mr. Chair, that's exactly my point, is that, you know, that local government is accountable in that way, and they'll, you know, they're out of step with the public. Public knows what to do about it, and or to, you know, go to the ballot. And I think that those mechanisms are ones that are readily available to citizens, and I think that's one of the things in local government that all of us, you know, work with, that we're close to the people and have to be in touch, or there's very easy access to those mechanisms, and that's something that is part of our system. And
well, thank you very much. I'm anxious that cities are successful, but I also would like to see some degree of responsibility, as well as the connection between the services that we're getting in addition to just the fee being charged, that they're trying to be some way of connecting those services, so that when the phone companies, as I say, as we become more and more automated and more and more high-tech, without the necessity of having lots of hardware, and particularly the hard lines that have been running up and down the alleys of your cities, then you folks will be able to say, hey, wait a minute, we should have found a different way to support our police or firemen or the other kinds of services, or to let the folks know that that the property taxes are going to have to take on a new form in those cities. Representative Comp.
I just wanted to make a comment, Chairman Butler, as all of us here on the committee know, and the people in the audience, this is a huge, huge issue. My grandson asked me 2 weeks ago, Grandma, what do you think about me having a cell phone? He's 10 years old. 10 years old. And I said, well, why? I don't see that you need one. He says, well, almost all my friends have one. 10 years old. And
true.
Oh, it is true. It is true. We better figure this out. And if you and the cities and the business don't figure it out, we're going to have to up here. So work hard.
I have full faith that we'll be able to do that with your good help.
So I think they need to tackle it first.
Thank you very much. David, one last item.
Representative Cobb, Mr. Chair, just a response to that as a parent. When my 13-year-old wanted one, it was one of those win-wins. For him, it was freedom. For a parent, it was a tether, because there's no excuse of never not being able to get a hold of them. So
that's exactly right.
Thank you.
Thank you very kindly. We appreciate you being here. Thank you, Mary. With that, we will go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3353. Okay. We'll open a public hearing on 3376. Paul? You want to take me back?
Sure.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the House Bill 3376 comes to you from the Oregon Association of County Treasurers and Finance Officers, who requested that the bill be drafted. Just a very general background. I believe the public purpose is an effort to ensure that all public deposits are fully protected. Essentially, what the bill does is replace a lot of detailed language and statutes with expanded Treasury rulemaking authority and responsibility. I have talked a little bit with Treasury about it. They feel there would be a fiscal impact as the bill is currently written, and do have some questions around the language and portions of the bill. And my understanding is that there is an amendment in the works now.
Fine. Thank you, Paul. Let's see. We have signed up Sherry Anderson, Association of County Treasurers from Clackamas County, William Lewis III, Public Schools, Springfield Public Schools, And then let's see, Michelle Hawkins, also Linn County Treasurer. Sherry, you start, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for having this hearing for us today. We bring before you a bill that, as public officials and finance officers, we believe is very, very critical to the protection of public funds in the state of Oregon. And I'm going to explain a little bit about what the current law is. And you have a handout that also goes through some of these numbers. Currently, as the treasurer of Clackamas County, I have a checking account at U.S. Bank, a number of them actually, but we have an account at U.S. Bank. And when we make deposits into that bank, we have a balance. Whenever I believe that balance may change dramatically, I'm required to notify U.S. Bank of my expected highest balance that I would anticipate, and then they are required to collateralize that balance at 25%. Now, when I say collateralize, I am referring to pledging of actual securities which would back those funds if the bank were to default. So there's actually treasuries and agencies and different types of securities that back that become the collateral for our deposits. And the key there is the 25% number. In the state of Oregon, as it sits right now, only 25% of my balances on any given day in a U.S. bank or any other bank's checking account is collateralized. As I said, as public officials, we believe that we should be entitled to more. I believe that the citizens of the cities and counties and school districts and the state of Oregon would like to see their public funds be collateralized at 100% or thereabout, and that we just believe that this is very important. It hasn't been a problem, but that doesn't mean that it won't become a problem at some point. I used a little example of the city of Oregon City, which is one of the cities in Clackamas County. If they were to have $2.1 million in their checking account at U.S. Bank, the first $100,000 of that account would be collateralized by the FDIC. That's every account has 100%, $100,000 collateralization by the FDIC insurance. So that leaves a balance of $2 million that is uncollateralized at that point. Under ORS 295, U.S. Bank would then pledge collateral at 25%. So they'd pledge $500,000 of collateral, leaving $1.5 million of public funds uncollateralized and unsecured. In the case of a county, and that's probably, I believe, why this came from the county governments, we have tax collection issues. So every November in Clackamas County, I collect close to $400 million, which goes into Clackamas County's checking account. While it's being cleared, I mean, checks have to clear, deposits have to go into those accounts, and until I can turn those funds over to the local government investment pool to send out, not to the Springfield School District, but to the school districts and the fire districts and the cities in Clackamas County, that those funds are under my control and they fall under my collateral agreement.
How long does it take, Mr. Sherry?
It depends. I would say 2 to 3 days.
Okay.
So we're not talking a long period of time, but if we were to lose, if U.S. Bank was to default in a sudden and unforeseen, there are some triggers in the law now that the Department of Consumer, they can up a collateral requirements on a bank that they feel is in jeopardy. But if something were to happen prior to that being their collateral being upped, we would stand to lose three-quarters of that $400 million. And that is not Clackamas County's money. That money belongs to the school districts and the fire districts in the city. It has never been tested, to my knowledge, what would happen, but I could foresee, because the funds are in my hands, that it would be Clackamas County's, could be Clackamas County's responsibility. Mm-hmm. And that's just something that all the county treasurers feel very uncomfortable with, and we would like to see change.
Can you move it to the pool any quicker and then give credits back out of the pool?
The problem is we have to wait till the funds are actually the bank gives us credit for the funds the day or the next day, but sometimes the funds may take, just like your check, if you send it to New York, may take longer to clear. We have people who pay property taxes, especially mortgage companies, who do property taxes that may take longer to clear. So while those funds are attempting to clear, they are in our bank account. And then you would come down to a question as to what had really cleared at that point.
Okay.
So we just feel that the risk, while it, you know, we don't expect it to happen, we feel that the exposure that we face and the exposure of the public funds are too great. So we formed a committee, a group of a number of county treasurers, Michelle and Marion County and Lane County and Klamath County. There's quite a few of us, Washington County, Multnomah County. We also have bankers on our committee. We have banking representatives from Key Bank, Bank of America, and U.S. Bank who've been working with us. We have Harvey Rogers, who's an attorney. We have school district representatives. We have city representatives who are serving on that committee. And we have come up with how we would like to see the statutes changed. And the way that we have approached this is from a pooled approach. We didn't feel that it was necessary to come at banks and tell them, we feel you have to collateralize every one of our deposits at 102%, considering the risk is not, you know, it's not immediate that every bank would go under, but rather a pooled approach based on the state of Washington has a pooled approach where everyone's collateral goes into a pool, and then if one bank did have to default and there was not enough collateral to cover their accounts, then the collateral of other banks would become available to pay that off. And that affords us with a better sense of closer to 100% collateral, and it also doesn't cost the bank as much as it would if they had to collateralize at 102. They accept some risk, but we think we accept risk too.
Thank you very much, Sherry, for your testimony. And this is an interesting approach. And let's go ahead. Let's see, William Lewis,
Chairman Butler, and representative of the Revenue Committee. Thank you for your time today. My name is William Lewis, and I work for Springfield Public Schools. I am here to support House Bill 3376 in regards to the rewrite of ORS 295. Springfield Schools puts a lot of time and effort into complying with ORS 295, and inevitably we find ourselves in out of compliance for short periods of time. This automatically triggers negative commentary into our annual audit, and I find it interesting that we put all this work and effort into it, and yet we only have 25% protection on the bottom line is we only have 25% protection in case of failure of local institution. We, as the district, Springfield Schools, like to support our local economy. We're the largest employer in the city of Springfield, and we like to have relationships with our local banks. From the finance perspective, that potentially puts us at a little bit more risk. These banking institutions are smaller, and we would like to potentially do more business with these banks to support the local economy, and House Bill 3376 gives us the opportunity to potentially have 100% protection and support our local economy by putting money at our local banking institutions. I think Sherry's done an excellent job of giving you examples of the actual rewrite. It's supported by cities, counties, and as well as school districts, and we would at Springfield, we definitely support House Bill 3376. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis. And finally, Michelle Hawkins, Lynn County.
Thank you, Chair Butler and committee members. I actually just got called this morning and to ask if I could come up here and help out with this bill. I'm actually the vice president of the Oregon Association of County Treasurers and Finance Officers this year, so I'm also here on behalf of them.
Thank you for your service to the county.
One of the things I want to talk about today is just a piece of all of us is that we actually work as county treasurers and finance officers for smaller entities. Each one of us has a very large portfolio at some time during the year, but the actuality is that we have, in my district, about 65 districts that are very small. Out of those districts, the majority of them do not have their money at the pool 100%. They do have a majority of their money because they have to keep it liquid in order to make payroll and whatnot every single month. So every single one of our districts actually has over that $100,000. And when I went to them to explain to them what the collateralization really was and that they had to listen and read the language that said that it was actually only 25%, I would say that over 50% of them did not know that. And so I'm actually here on their behalf because they were actually appalled at the fact that this, you mean to tell me that we're really not collateralized? I mean, it's just a portion of? A lot of these districts are in smaller entities which do not have major banks. They don't have a U.S., a Key, a Wells, or an Umpqua, or a Bank of America. They actually have just a savings and loan or just Ma and Pa right across the street that they do business with.
Build
so,
saving and loan, huh?
Yes. So when they found this out, it was kind of like, okay, now how do we, you know, help this piece of language get through so that this does actually save us if something were to happen? Now, I think of what Orange County went through when they actually had all of their things happen to them a few years ago. We changed the language in our statutes to bring us up to par so that wouldn't happen, so that we're very cautious about what we do business with and what we build our portfolios off of. So we can't just go out and take things out that is not covered by what law says. So I'm here on behalf of the smaller entities to cover them, because if they only have $200,000 and this were to go under just their small bank in one foul swoop, they could be down $75,000 and that could put them under for the year, and we're talking lots of jobs. And so I'm actually here on behalf of them also to cover what they have on the table.
Michelle, if those banks went down overnight, we wouldn't be just talking
No. This is actually just a piece of language also that I'm concerned about, is the part about at nighttime when I come to close my banking statement for the night, and let's say in one night I may have had $30 million come in and my collateralization was at 25 and I didn't catch it before the 2 o'clock deadline. All of a sudden, I've got to think of what I can do with that extra $5 million in order to cover me so my auditors don't write me up at the end of the day.
Now, there's a lot of weeks I don't make that much. Questions of these particular folks? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. In my real life, I used to be an accountant, and to be a CPA, you've got to do an internship somewhere, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, I don't know. But I did an internship at the Hibernia Bank in San Francisco, and that was part of my job, was to monitor the movement of the securities on a daily basis for the several months that I was involved on that particular job, and to watch the virtually hundreds of millions of dollars of securities move to one side of the room or to the other. You stop and say, you know, I just hope they're all there in the morning. So, thank you very much. I appreciate you being here. We'll go ahead then and excuse you folks and include Tim Martinez from the Oregon Bankers Association, Tiana Suatha. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, from U.S. Bank. Is it Tiana Suatha?
Tiana.
Tiana Suatha. Okay. Tiana, why don't you go ahead and go first? We know what Tim's going to say.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, I am Tiana Suatha, a vice president and relationship manager for U.S. Bank Government Banking Department in Oregon. I'm here today in support of House Bill 3376 pertaining to protection of public funds deposits. Oregon has a long history of financial institutions with a good reputation for providing banking services to individuals, businesses, and the public sector. I represent U.S. Bank, which has been a fixture in Oregon for more than 100 years. U.S. Bank provides banking services in 24 states, from the Northwest to the Midwestern region of the country. In Oregon, we currently have 177 branch offices located throughout the state. In regard to the public sector, U.S. Bank has dedicated a team of professionals who specialize in servicing the unique needs of governmental clients. I am a member of this team and work very closely with our local governmental clients in Western Oregon. Most states require financial institutions to pledge collateral on deposits of public funds which exceed the 100,000 limit from FDIC. The goal of pledging collateral is to ensure safety and soundness for public entities in the event of a financial institution's failure. Oregon's public funds protection statutes were adopted in 1967 and are published in ORS Chapter 295. There have only been minor modifications to the system during the past 38 years. In Oregon, public officials are required to request their bank to provide a certificate of participation as evidence of collateral pledged to the Oregon State Treasury under the program. To support the certificate, the financial institutions must pledge collateral for at least 25% of the face value of the certificate. In the event of the financial institution's failure, public officials would first recover funds through the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or FDIC. Then the failed institution's total collateral pledged for public agencies would be distributed proportionately among the agencies holding a valid certificate of participation. Public agencies are only entitled to collect the lesser of their actual balance, or 25% of the face value of their certificate. This is widely misunderstood aspect of Oregon's current law. Certificate amounts are subjective and often have little correlation to actual balances held at an institution. Public agencies are audited to ensure their certificate face value is always higher than the actual balances. Therefore, many public officials request collateral in excess of their actual balances to ensure compliance with the law. This increases the overhead cost for financial institutions. It also creates a false sense of security, as the public's depositors' claim is limited, as outlined above, to 25%. Oregon's system for protecting public funds deposit needs improvement. It does not provide sufficient protection of public funds, is needlessly cumbersome and expensive to administer for public agencies and financial institutions. House Bill 3376 would change ORS 295 and replace Oregon's system of public funds protection with a simpler program modeled after the state of Washington's Public Deposit Protection Act. Under the new program, collateral requirements would be based on actual balances rather than an estimate as they are today. It also allows financial institutions to choose to participate in a shared liability program, providing greater protections of public funds. Under a shared liability program, if a financial institution fails, the affected public entity is paid first from FDIC insurance coverage and then from the failed institution's pledge, collateral, or other remaining assets. If the loss is still not covered, the remainder could be recovered by a proportionate assessment against the other financial institutions participating in the collateral pool. Ultimately, the new program would reduce the cost of protecting public funds by streamlining administrative procedures for banks and their public depositors. A change in Oregon's public funds protection legislation is necessary to provide better protection of public funds and reduce the cost of protecting public funds. The creation of a shared liability system would be mutually beneficial to the public and the banking industry. The Washington State Public Protection Act provides an excellent model on which to base a new system in Oregon. I support House Bill 3376 with some amendments to clarify the details and requirements of the new program. Thank you for your consideration in this matter.
Thank you. And Paul, the amendments we have coming from Treasury is, I assume, will assist in this clarification of the details, how the new program would run. And my hope is that they will bring us into conformity with what we were trying to model off the Washington State Public Protection Act.
That's my understanding, Mr. Chair. There is some of the definitions and references within this bill that are not consistent with Treasury's understanding of those.
Okay. All right. And Tim, why don't you go ahead with representing Board of Bankers.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. The chair made reference that he knew what I was going to say. I wish he'd tell me because I'm trying to figure out what I am going to say. I guess I will start. I'll start by saying that I'm here to support my friends and OBA members. But this proposal has a fairly lengthy history. And I guess really the first thing I should say is that the Oregon Bankers Association strongly believes that the public funds on deposit in Oregon institutions are safe today and safe yesterday and will be safe tomorrow. One of the things that I didn't hear mentioned, and I apologize, I missed the very beginning of the testimony on this bill, but I didn't hear that so far, is the fact that the state treasurer does have today the ability to require these funds to be collateralized at 110% if the treasurer believes that a bank is at risk. It's a complicated, I shouldn't say complicated, there's a process that occurs when DCBS notifies the treasurer of a bank that's in trouble. And then the treasurer has the ability to do that. That's happened since the time that I've worked for the Bankers Association, and it works very, very well. So I think the first point I'd like to make is that certainly the association doesn't believe that public funds on deposit today are at risk. We certainly understand, and we've met with county treasurers beginning last fall on this issue. We went down this road about 4 or 5 years ago, and at the end of the day, the association could not agree internally on which was the best way to go. I will tell you, times have changed. The nice thing about this bill is it does come from bank customers, i.e. the treasurers. So we are working very, very hard to try to see if we can't come to a positive solution to this issue.
Just a moment. We're going to call this a subcommittee of the committee because we have just one less member than what we need. So continue on,
Mr. Chairman. Still Tim Martinez, Oregon Bankers Association. So that is helpful that it is indeed coming from, you know, bank customers today. We did see the initial draft a couple of months ago. Our committee has met. The bill itself, it was printed, I believe, early last week. Our council is reviewing it, and I would expect that we will have a financial officer's conference call later on this week. U.S. Bank is represented on that call as well. And the issue, frankly, is one that we don't have around here very much anymore, is a large bank versus small bank issue. On the one hand, it does appear that this bill would give community banks an opportunity to get deposits that they currently can't or don't receive. The other side of the coin is those community banks are now at greater or would be at greater risk if there was a failure of a large bank. So then the question becomes, if it is a large bank, what percentage would the small bank be forced to cover, and what does that do to that community bank? So there are some issues here, but I just want to assure the committee and the proponents, the county treasurers, that we continue to work with them, and we would hopefully by in the very near future have a positive report back to the committee.
Thank you very much, Tim, and thank you for that testimony. Tian, I want to thank you especially for your testimony. Your written testimony is very, very clear. It sets out, particularly here on page 2, really sets out what it is that we're attempting to do and attempting to streamline both the administrative procedure for both the banks and the public depositors and to provide this benefit for the public. So, and Tim, I appreciate your mentioning that we're under no grave risk today, but I think that Since the events of 9/11, folks just believe that we live in a little bit different world today, and would like to have that additional assurance from time to time. And that's, I think, in part what this is about, to see if we can find a better way. So, again, if there are no further questions for you folks, thank you very much. Thank you, Dan. Appreciate it. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3376. Mm-hmm. I think I got everybody that was supposed to have testified on that one. If anybody sitting around that needs to have testified on that, I've got some folks from Treasury let's see that.
Darren's okay.
Yeah, oh, okay. Where's he at? All right. He knows what his job is. He's going to meet with those folks. So I think I saw Kate Richardson here, too.
She was here. Okay.
Thank you very much. We will close the public hearing on 3376. I think I may have already done that. But we will open a public hearing on 3340. And, again, this is a subcommittee of the committee.
2340.
I beg your pardon. That's a opening on 2340. I don't do a good job with numbers. Mary?
Yes.
Mr.
Chair. House Bill 2340 allows a Rural Fire Protection District Board to adopt an ordinance as provided in ORS 198510 for 198600 that creates a fee for any service provided by that district, but the fee may not exceed the cost of the service provided, grants the fee authority in addition to any authority granted under local law or by documents that created the district. Reference to the ORS 198.600, I should say, adds a penalty of $250, imprisonment, or both if fees are not paid. Current law is that, well, some background, I should say. There are roughly, from the data I collected, there are roughly 250 rural fire protection districts in Oregon. They range in size from a small district that might cover 20 to 50 mile service area to a large district that covers an area of 50 square miles or more. Most, roughly 230 of the districts, are quite small. 10 are about mid-size and 4 to 5 are large. Some of the rural fire districts have mutual aid agreements with the Department of Forestry, which allows for an exchange of services without monetary compensation. Some of the rural protection districts currently charge for some service, special types of services, while others do not. There's no uniform practice. I've collected, I was fortunate enough to get some data from the Oregon Fire District Association, Directors Association, Ms. Ingram, and she sent me some data that shows me basically across small, medium, and large districts some of the types of services that are collected. And in some cases, they're collected in one district but not in another. These may include things like basic life support at $650 per hour plus $11 per mile. It could be something that's not charged right now, but in a district, small or medium district, some of them are trying to consider implementing a fee schedule for motor vehicle accidents and inspections. The range on the services that aren't provided right now can include a fee for inspection programs, classes of fire hazards, finding class hazards, giving CPR classes, things like that. They're not covered now. The data that I collected really came from a gentleman who was a fire district manager in the Douglas Fire District area, in Fire District Number 2, and he gave me kind of a range on budgets. And I took a sample and just sort of got a feeling for what that estimate might be, but basically without really knowing exactly what services they're planning for, there's nothing uniform that I could get from any of the sources, I put together what I thought would be a reasonable estimate of roughly $12.8 million. That's about $6 million a year in additional charges.
That would be all local fee?
Yes.
Locally collected?
Yes,
wouldn't
sure.
Affect the schools at all? The school taxes?
No. These are all just services.
Direct service fees?
Right.
All right.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mary. Jeff Johnson, Mr. Blackmore, and General Ingram, if you'll come forward, please. Is General Ingram has just handed out books. I can see the size of her written testimony, 25 copies, though. Give us something to read there. Thank you, General.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I promise my testimony will be brief. This is a very simple bill. Genoa Ingram, Oregon Fire District Directors Association, Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, and Clackamas Fire District 1. Quite simply, we're here today because the statute is unclear as to whether or not fire districts may charge to recoup some of the charges for, recoup some of the costs of the services they provide within their scope of practice. It's very clear with regard to the statutes what municipal fire departments may do and other special districts. In fact, I attached to the back of my testimony a matrix that the Special Districts Association asked me to prepare that represents a matrix of authority of for the various districts to collect fees. Fire districts, the fire district statute was very, very unclear. Additionally, there have been legal opinions on both sides as to whether or not fire districts could or could not charge fees to recoup their costs. And because of that, the Oregon Fire District Directors Association asked a legislator to pose the question to legislative council. And what we got back was, yes, you may charge fees so long as it's in your charter. Fire districts, as you know, do not have charters, and so we were even more confused than ever, and we felt that we should come here and ask. And I'd like to take a second, a break in my testimony, just to thank Mary Ayala. She put a tremendous amount of work and research into this, and I'm afraid that we were not very helpful because, it was very difficult to quantify across the board, you know, what was being charged and what was not being charged. Additionally, some fire districts that were charging for services have stopped because their legal counsel told them that they could not. We were very concerned about the liability that we were that the districts would be left to if we did not clarify the legislation. When we appeared before the other committee, it was the House Ag Committee, Representative Haas and Representative Boquist, both heard testimony, and they asked us that when we come before the Revenue Committee, and certainly they don't want to speak for them, but they were very supportive, honest. They did ask that when we came before Revenue Committee to clarify some of the things that are being charged for, and those types of services would be the EMT calls, the ambulance transfers. For example, Representative Olson in our neck of the woods, Adair Fire is right next to Highway 99. And you need to know that the fire districts are supported only by property taxes. They don't have any other means of supporting themselves. Adair is a very small area. However, because they sit right on Highway 99, they're called quite frequently to make calls out on Highway 99. And this gives them a way to recoup their fees that they could not possibly recover given how tiny the community of Adair is. Again, our primary concern is that of liability and the conflicting legal advice that the districts are getting, and we would encourage the committee or the chair to hold a work session in the very near future and pass this bill out.
This only is relative to the rural fire protection districts. In other words, an ambulance service district, I know she had some ambulance services provided. Those must be provided by rural fire districts as well, then?
Mr. Chair, this would apply only to fire districts. Yes, okay. Special districts that are fire districts.
Okay, there is a definition, a constitutional or otherwise statutory definition of a rural fire district, then?
Mr. Chair, there is, yes.
Okay, excellent. Okay. Who wants to go first, Jeff or Robert?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Johnson. I'm the fire chief at Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. We're a small little outfit in the Portland metropolitan area, serves 9 cities, about 400 and something thousand folks, and parts of 3 counties. And I dare say that we're probably here as much, I'm here as much today for the smaller agencies that can't be here throughout Oregon as I am for our own entity. Primarily, I think this has to do with creating opportunities for you to use fees both as an incentive for good behavior in the fire safety community and a disincentive. Many times we actually have, say in the construction world, we have developers actually offer to pay more to get something moved through quicker. But that would constitute a fee, and we would be unable to do that. There are many smaller jurisdictions throughout Oregon where their tax base, their revenue base, is actually not where their problem is coming from. They may have a major freeway. They may have a major recreational area, and their units are actually tied up, taking care of folks like me driving through their area when they actually have a small municipal area and commercial tax base that's paying the bill. This would give them an opportunity to levy a fee to try to stay in business. After all, their resources are being allocated to someone that isn't a constituent of theirs. I think outside of those things, it really creates an opportunity for us to deal with some things like nuisance alarms. Every time one of our units is out there time after time after time, we don't have the option to say, no, we can't go. We have to go. We need to create an incentive for folks to deal with those kinds of things. It also deals with things like inspection frequency. But I also want to touch on what it does for the commercial side of our business in terms of opportunity. Businesses, say, with a confined space requirement, they have to have a standby team of people that are confined space qualified on standby when they make an entry. Well, a fire department, we have to have a team like that on 24 by 365. Anyway, that is something we'd probably look at doing, but that would constitute a fee. It would save the businesses in our service area a substantial amount of money over keeping their own, but currently we're precluded from doing it, as mentioned. I think if approved, this does require adoption by our board of directors at the local level. People do seem to find us on meeting night for an opportunity to comment on things that affect them, like raise fees or change the nature of their business. And so I do think there is an opportunity for people that are affected negatively or affirmatively to oppose this or support it at the local level. With that, I just urge your support of 2340, and thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Robert?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, staff, thank you very much for your time. My name is Bob Blackmore. I'm an attorney, and I'm general counsel to Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, and I know for a fact that I'm at least one half of the responsible party for the conflicting opinions. What I'd like to do is to at least clarify the legal posture here for the record and answer any questions you may have with regard to that. Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue is a creature of statute under ORS 478. As such, it is a special district, and the powers that it has are those that are expressly granted or necessarily implied by that chapter. It is not a home rule authority entity, such as all your cities, all your counties. It may only charge that which is specifically identified in the statute itself. Whether or not a power is implied is strictly construed against a governmental entity. In other words, the courts, when they look at the power, unless they find it specifically enumerated in the statute or necessarily implied, they're going to be very tough about that. They're not going to grant the entity that power. And that's the reason for the conflicting legal opinions in trying to decide what is an implied authority of the district. Now, you can imagine until you go to court, you don't really know. And we have gone through extensive review and analysis of what that implied authority allows us to do. Competent legal counsel for other jurisdictions have also looked at it, and they've come to differing conclusions. And as such, you have probably as many different opinions out there as you have legal counsel representing these special districts as to what they can do in special areas that they can have these additional fees. The purpose of this statute is hopefully to clarify what our authority is, and that is to define that they do have the authority for these types of fees, to take away that uncertainty, and that'll put all the districts on the same level in terms of what they're able to charge. Any questions? I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you very much. Bob, inasmuch as you're the attorney here on this particular matter, I would like to have you tell me within the bill how these fees that are provided by the fire district will not exceed the cost of the service provided and how they'll be calculated so that we know that folks don't come back and just tell us that we've grant yeah. carte blanche for somebody to go willy-nilly with fees?
Under the bill, and it's number four, the middle sentence says, a fee created under authority of this section may not exceed the cost to the district of providing the service. So it is explicit in the bill itself.
Now, if I was a cost accountant, I could throw everything in the kitchen sink in there. Tell me what that means. I need to know what cost is. Overhead, how much overhead is allocated to cost? How much direct cost? Is that direct cost?
For you are a cost accountant, aren't you?
That's about as bad as anything anyone could ever say to it. I just need to have an idea of what that is.
It is not defined in the statute, and so I suspect that it would be up to a court or a reasonable interpretation as to what cost is, and that would usually follow your generally accepted accounting principles, your GAAP principles is my sense of it, is that you would have to look at what is generally accepted in the accounting industry to define cost.
I'm going to guess that'd be some sort of a full costing arrangement where it would include everything. Direct cost and indirect cost and overheads and those kinds of things. Did you have a response to that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you're correct. It is not defined in statute, and you will see both sides of it covered. Sometimes you'll see an incremental cost. We typically, when we strike intergovernmental agreements between two neighboring fire departments, it's always a debate about whether you covering 10 calls for me, I owe you X percent of your fire department operation, or whether I owe you the cost of your diesel and Band-Aids for those 10 calls. As a general rule, my experience has been I've seen it fully costed, maybe in an ambulance fee kind of environment, and I've seen it incrementally costed on the other side. One way to do it would be to expressly state it in statute. Another way to do it, which is how it generally works out, is that's what the public process at the local government level is used for, is if you try to fully cost something, you generally get a lot more feedback from the community than if you try to incrementally cost it. And it's that reasonableness factor that happens in the public hearings that have kept them reasonable to date, at least in my experience. But you are correct in that it isn't expressly called for in the bill nor in statute.
I'm anxious about that because as we have these issues, the fully costed costs, particularly where you're involved in Genoa's testimony, where you're involved in the potential of things like fire or ambulance service, those kinds of things. Folks are gonna feel like they've been gouged if they come back previously something that was costing them a few hundred dollars, and you fully cost an ambulance service, that's thousands of dollars potentially, and particularly out in rural Oregon where those are services that are granted at long distances, it may take hours and hours of EMT's time. So I just need to get a better feel, and I need something in the record to give us some direction there. Jenna?
Hi, Mr. Chair, Jenna Ingram. My mind is just turning here. What I'm thinking is currently, though, this is already allowed for municipal departments, and we have not heard that there were abuses or complaints in that area, and the rural fire districts are just looking for the same to be on the same level as the municipals.
And so you would, if you have a municipal adjacent to you, that your fees would not be greater than the municipal? Is that what I'm hearing?
Mr. Chair, that's my vision of how this will work. They just have asked to be on the same level, not to be greater than, not to backfill their budget or anything of that nature. They just don't want to be in the hole.
But the municipals, do they do full costing or do they do flat charges? I guess I'm concerned about that approach too.
They have home rule authority, and they can define that for themselves as to how they proceed. And so it is up to that specific entity to define how they're going to proceed on it. Here,
Bob, you don't have home rule authority, so you're...
We don't, so we're asking for specific authority. What this does provide, however, is that it must be passed by ordinance, which requires two hearings and public involvement. So as the chief was referring to the fact that there would be that type of involvement, it is, in fact...
The reason I didn't attend the public hearing was I didn't need the ambulance back then. Now that I've needed them and used them and and get the bill, then that's when I'm concerned about the fee that was passed. Butler, Jeff?
Chair Butler, members of the committee, I think the two areas where you have the greatest exposure to, say, full cost a fire department operation and have a very large, surprising bill, those are most likely going to happen in the area of an ambulance transport, EMS, or wildfire. And I want to take those separately. EMS in Oregon is you can only become a transport provider as a fire department in Oregon if you compete in a public process against the private sector should they choose to compete against you in what's known as an ambulance service area award process convened and awarded by the county commission. So in the cases I've seen, the fire departments that have had to compete against the private sector for that opportunity generally try to keep their private their cost modeling as private sectorish as possible, or they aren't cost competitive. So there's already a built-in competition in ambulance transport because of the ASA award process. So that's already dealt with. You can't even go into the business of the public provider unless you win an award in that ambulance service area. So that takes care of that one and keeps you honest, essentially. Second area is the area of wildland firefighting. And wildland firefighting are those bills are prescriptive also because the state fire marshal's office adopts what's known as a firefighting reimbursement schedule, and that applies to all fire departments in Oregon. So if Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue is called to Christmas Valley, Oregon, on a major wildland deployment, we only get to bill our true and actual costs, and we're reimbursed for our apparatus based on a schedule adopted by the state fire marshal's office, and that applies across all of Oregon. So the big cost issues are really already dealt with in terms of having a big surprise bill.
In general, I think you generated some of this relating to fees, sample district here for basic life support, advanced life support, advanced life support 2, $650 an hour, $750 an hour, $825 an hour, plus $11 per mile on each of those. And Chief Johnson, well, you tell me that they have to bid on those and compete. You know, there's places in Oregon where people just won't bid.
Correct.
I mean, there's no way that they're going to. I mean, who wants to bid for McDermott, Oregon? So, I mean, it's by default that, you know, that we have to have some other folks handle it. And if I had to have a, rural fire department handle that, the price would just be prohibitive to try and it's something like what General indicated with regard to another Almsville or whatever community it was.
Adair
next to 99. I mean, we're on Highway 95, which is all of the Canadian to Mexican border traffic that goes through between Jordan Valley and McDermott, Oregon, McDermott, Nevada. And the accident ratio is terrible, and when they have to pick somebody up, they pick them up in pieces down there normally. So anyway, I'm anxious about those kinds of things. But
Mr. Chair, if I may?
Yes, if you would.
When I was working with Mary to do the research on this bill, I ended up calling probably 30 or more rural fire protection districts. And what I heard from those who were not charging is that they wanted to be able to adopt the schedule that had been laid out by the state fire marshal's office, but that they were concerned that they were not sure if they had the authority to do that. I didn't hear any of them, you know, talking about trying to increase their budgets in any way, shape, or form. What I heard them say was, you know, we're running in the red. You know, we're holding the bake sales, for the turnout equipment. We just want to be able to recoup the costs that we're out. And the main concern was that every other special district has that ability. If you're a parks special district, you can charge for the use of your facilities. If you're a library district, you can charge fees for, the books. If you're a fire district, if you are a fire district, you don't have that ability. If you're a municipal fire department or any other special district, you have that ability. This is the only one.
General, I would like something on the record to just give us some idea of what that would look like. And if we can get something between now and the time that we need to move forward on House Bill 2340. I think that would be appropriate.
Thank
Further
you,
questions,
Chair.
Members of the committee? Thank you very much for
Thank
participating.
You.
We'll go ahead and close the public hearing on 2340 and open a public hearing on 2125. Let's see. Yes, that's right. 2125.
I'll just say,
Maz, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's good to be back. For the record, Maz and Manic, Legislative Revenue Office. And House Bill 2125, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, comes to us from the Oregon Employment Department. And in this, it will try to rectify an omission that occurred in the 2001 session when House Bill 3596 wasn't at that time able to specify for the Indian tribes who pay as local governments as employers when they choose to be in the unemployment insurance system, that they get to pay that half of the employment department levy at that time. Now, the 2001 legislation, if it was active in 2005, there's about 13 tribes out of 28 that would have participated or participating today. It would not have made a big increase in their unemployment insurance taxes. I believe a small probably increase on two of them, two tribes, on a 0.1, on another 0.3. So for that matter, revenue impact of the bill is probably very small, minimal to none, I'd say, for the 05, 07 biennium and the biennium later.
Thank you, Maz. I'm just a little bit confused. Oregon has 9 federally recognized tribes. We're talking about 28 tribes here that pay tax. Are there more tribes doing business in Oregon than the 9 federally recognized tribes?
That's a good point, Mr. Chair. That
must have some folks who are coming into town.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Tamara Brickman, Legislative Coordinator for the Oregon Employment Department. That should say tribal entities. We have 9 federally recognized tribes within the state, but they have several different entities for business purposes.
Okay.
So I'm just clarifying that for the record.
28 tribal entities. So that would be it could be a tribal entity, it could be a tribal casino, it could be a tribal hotel, it could be a tribal truck stop. Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that clarification, Tamara. Pat Delaval, Employment Department.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Pat Delaval. I am the manager of field operations for the Employment Department Tax Section. And I'm here to discuss House Bill 2125. And the purpose of that bill is to amend Oregon law to treat taxpaying Indian tribes in the same manner as taxpaying governmental entities for the charging of extended benefits.
I think that's fair.
When I speak of extended benefits, I'm talking about a specific federal state program, which is triggered in long periods of high unemployment. The Federal Consolidated Appropriations Act, or CAA, of 2001 required that all employees of Indian tribes be covered with unemployment insurance. In 2001, the Oregon Legislative Assembly adopted House Bill 3596 to comply with that law. As a condition of state conformity, Indian tribes were given the same options available to other governmental entities either to pay a quarterly payroll tax or reimburse the employment department for unemployment benefits of its employees. Under the Federal State Extended Unemployment Compensation Act of 1970, an extension of benefits may be available to unemployed individuals during long periods of high unemployment. For for-profit tax-paying employers, the federal government and the state UI trust fund each chip in 50% of those charges. The federal government does not pay anything for governmental entities or Indian tribes. Governmental entities and Indian tribes that reimburse benefits pay 100% of extended benefit charges. Taxpaying governmental entities pay one half of extended benefits to make up for the portion the federal government does not pay. Due to an oversight in the development of House Bill 3596, the language to charge taxpaying Indian tribes one half of extended benefits was omitted. This bill will correct that by inserting language that provides for taxpaying Indian tribes to pay one half of extended benefits. Without this, the state unemployment trust fund pays their share.
Pat, let me just ask a question. This is being referred from general government. Was there any testimony in opposition in general government?
No, there was not.
Okay. Has there been any testimony brought forward from any of the nine federally recognized tribes in opposition to the to joining the pool?
As a matter of fact, there is not, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. We sent a letter out to them in June of 2004 and have received no negative response whatsoever.
Any response, positive response?
We've had some questions about what the ramifications would be, but we've not received any.
Can you please poll Karen Quigley down at the Commission on Indian Services and make certain that, or Tamara's going to come forward and say she already has. Tamara?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again for the record, Tamara Brickman. We have had communications with Karen Quigley all along on this bill.
Excellent.
And have not had any comments back. And just as a matter of fact, when I was out in the hall earlier this afternoon, ran into Justin Martin, correct?
Yes.
And asked him if they had any concerns, and he said he has not been given any direction with respect to having any concerns. And we have also spoke with, I've spoken with Michael Mason from the Warm Springs Tribes and have not had any negative comments or concerns.
Thank you very much, Tamara. Questions of any members? I think that resolves the questions that I have. Thank you very much. Thank you both, Pat, Tamara. Appreciate it. Colleagues, that finishes the agenda for today, and I will close the House Bill 2125, and we will close the committee for today. Thank you for your extended time. And